Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Lawmakers and citizen watchdog groups last week found common ground on a proposal to change how congressional district lines are drawn in Ohio. The proposal goes before voters on the May primary ballot. We're talking about that and much more today on our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Engels, State House reporter for Cleveland.com, Jackie Borchardt, and Columbus Dispatch Public Affairs Editor Daryl Rowland. Welcome to the show, everybody.
Great to be here.
Good morning.
All right. So let's talk about the redistricting proposal. There were several naysayers on the program last week. Didn't think they'd actually be able to pull it off. But they did, right up to the line because they had to get it done before the filing deadline. Right, Daryl?
Right. So there was a couple of weeks ago, it seemed like this was dead in the water. In fact, the group that was the Citizens Coalition said it was, in fact, dead. We tried. We did our best, but we couldn't do it. But they kept at it. Frankly, thanks to persistence by a lot of people, Senate President Larry Alboff, the legislators involved from both parties. And, of course, the major impetus for all of this is the citizens groups. They had circulated their petition. If this fell through, they were going to go ahead and put it on the fall ballot. There was great incentive among the legislators, frankly, from both parties, to sort of, we want to keep that within the legislative process and not, sort of lose control of it. So without that, there's no question, I don't think it would have happened. So we've got it. It's a bit of a miracle because we have waves of washed ashore on these before and hit shoals and, just didn't make it. Then the 2005, the so-called Ron Amendments, Reform Ohio Now. A few years ago, Dan Takagi from here at OSU trying it with our old boss, Mike Curtin, involved. Fell short then, but the timing is right. The groups of coalitions on all sides of this issue were right, and it actually happened. Now it's up to Ohio voters.
Yeah. How does it compare to what voters approved for state legislative seats as far as the process goes? It's very different, isn't it?
It's a different process. It'll start again with the legislature. Like Daryl said, they'll have an opportunity to approve a map. And in order to do so, they need to have the approval of 50% of the minority party in both chambers. So they need a...
That's an increase.
That's an increase from what was originally, recommended or introduced in the first version. So that's being kind of praised on both sides for, it being incentive to... at least include the minority party in some of those, discussions and deliberations. If they can't meet that threshold, then it would go to that 7-member redistricting commission that issue one set up back in 2015. And then they would have an opportunity to draw a map. And the same standard applies to them as does with the state house districts, where of the 7, they need to have at least 2 votes of minority party members to pass a map. If they can't do that, so if they can't get the map, then the legislature has another opportunity to pass a map. And the threshold is a little bit lower for that minority party vote. And if they don't get the minority party vote, they still can pass a map, but it's going to have to, fall in line with a bunch of more restrictive criteria. So it is still possible at the end of this long process, 3-step process, that the majority party could pass a map. But it's going to have much more stringent criteria, and it's only going to be good for 4 years, which is a disincentive.
If they can't get it through one of those first two processes.
And if they can, they can't get the minority party to come along with them on the map.
And a shorter time on the maps, what's the significance of that?
Well,
Joe Engels?
The thought is that 4 years is not very long and that no one really wants that because it's harder to politically game the system in 4 years, if you know that in 4 years you're going to have to redo it. So, I think for stability, everyone wants a 10-year map. But this map still would allow gerrymandering. In the end, those 4-year maps could be gerrymandered and gerrymandered heavily. We don't know. I know that when they were looking at the way they were drawn or they could draw some districts, there were some that were drawn in a very gerrymandered way. Now, that being said, it's not going to be as easy to do that snake up on the lake like we see with Marcy Kaptur's mm-hmm. district or some of these districts that have, you know, four or five counties in them and that kind of thing. That's not likely to happen. But there still would be some gerrymandering.
And there is, yeah, and they're also, you know, up until this point, there hasn't been any criteria for drawing these maps. You know, I think it's a common misconception that they have to be, like, compact and competitive, and that doesn't exist. So there are what this would do is set some rules. And even in that first step, they're not as strict as I think, you know, advocates were hoping for, but there are some guidelines, you know, that you can't, I think one of them is elongate districts, the way that, you know, Joe is referencing the snake on the lake, the up near Toledo. In Cleveland that stretches that way. You wouldn't even under that first map be able to draw a district like that. It also limits the number of times that you can split a county. And the amendment does not say which counties would be eligible for which kinds of splits, but it's been explained that 65 counties would have to be kept whole within a district. They could not be split. Thinking just on Ohio's geography, that would likely be a lot of rural counties. And then I think it's 15 or 18. 18 could be split. 18. I'm trying to do my math here. I think it's 18 could be split once, so into two districts. Mm-hmm. And then 5 could be split twice into three districts.
And that includes the most populous counties.
The amendment is silent on which counties those are. It's up to the authority to decide.
But it gives them definitions, doesn't it?
No, okay. I mean, that part is not defined. And that was, you know, Representative Dan Ramos from Lorain. He's a Democrat from Lorain. That was one of his big oppositions to this, is that looking at that language, he said there were no safeguards to ensure that his county, for example, wouldn't be split less times than it already is now. Hmm. But I mean, look, Cuyahoga County is in four districts. Summit County is in four districts. At the best case, even worst case scenario out of this, they would be split less times than that.
You know, what about the 12th and 15th districts and the 3rd district, which is now held by Representative Joyce Beatty, right. Darryl Rowland? The open seat in the 12th district was formerly held by Republican Pat Tiberi. The 15th district is held by Republican Steve Stivers of Upper Arlington. And speaking of an elongated district, I often refer to that one. It goes all the way down to Brown County, I think. Might not anymore, but gets pretty dang close.
Yeah, it goes across south of Athens.
Okay. And they largely surround, and those two, 12th and the 15th, largely surround the 3rd district held by Joyce Beatty. One expert, I think I read this in your article, one expert called Franklin County a geographic nightmare for mapping purposes, and an entire tortured section of the ballot issue is dedicated to the county. What's the problem with poor old Franklin County?
Yeah, that's my colleague Jim Siegel's article, who covers the legislature. I had a good piece Sunday that's on Dispatch.com, of course, if I may get a little promo
absolutely.
In there. Because there's some really cool maps with it. I mean, I was, even as an average reader, I was just, you know, I think people would be fascinated to look at it. Franklin County is different. Columbus is different. And Columbus is the only city now that's large enough to contain an entire congressional district. The thought will be that is largely how Joyce Beatty's district is now, the 3rd Congressional District. So that the easiest route, I mean, nothing is certain, but the easiest route would be to keep that pretty much the same. But then you have sort of the leftover part of Columbus then that is beyond what one congressional district would be. So where does that go? Now you've got, as you said, Steve Stivers, who lives in Upper Arlington. His district was carved so it would include, you know, certain areas of the downtown. It was carved so it would purposely exclude the home of Mary Jo Kilroy, who at the time was going to run for, the district, excluded her from that 3rd congressional district for which she was going to run when that was an open seat. And then it goes way south into a lot of rural counties. Representative Pat Tiberi's district, the 15th, you know, goes east and north of Columbus. So which is going to happen? The thing is, Ohio, you know, again, we have 16 congressional districts now. Because our population is not growing as quickly as those of other states, mm-hmm. we will probably lose yet another congressional district. We'll be down to 15. So all these projections are pretty much, because again, they won't be done till after the next census. So all the projections are basically saying, okay, we got to divide Ohio's pie 15 ways. So
the districts are going to get bigger. I mean,
necessity, they'll get bigger. So each congressional district, I can't remember the number. It's like 700 some thousand or something like that. They keep getting bigger and bigger. So, yeah, one person represents that many people. And those have to be at least roughly equivalent around the state in terms of people.
And so why is it is that tortured section? I mean, what are they referring to when they say a tortured section of the ballot issue?
Well, like, for instance, now, it would prevent some of the things that happen now. Like, if you look at the maps, Pat Tiberi's district lies to the north of Joyce Beatty's district. The 12th is north of the 3rd, for the most part. It goes up into Delaware County, then comes out around and comes back in around New Albany and snags a little corner of the county there, then goes east to get some of Licking County. So all this in and out of counties and all that stuff, again, nothing is going to be a guarantee, but it would be minimized. The odds of that happening would be sharply minimized.
Hmm. Well, Columbus, though, it would be the only city where you would have to have more than one district, right, under the maps. Like Cleveland could fit within one. Cincinnati could fit within one. So, you have Columbus, and it's, just by its nature, would need to be split somewhere.
And Columbus itself,
it's
obviously,
sprawling nature, isn't that?
Well, it's population. I mean, it's population size.
Yeah, okay, gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, and with Columbus being predominantly Democratic, that's going to most likely be a Democratic district. And then the key comes because most of the rest of the county is Democratic as well. Columbus has gone very blue in recent years, but then almost any direction, then if you go outside of Franklin County, you're going to hit red counties. So from a political standpoint, it's going to be very interesting to see which way they go, if there's an attempt to make that a competitive map, or how that will shake out.
That's what I wanted to know is what was the end game here? I mean, are we going to get more competitive districts? Are we going to get districts that are more decided at the general election stage than at the primary stage? And we don't know right now, right?
Right. And like I was saying, the fact that you can gerrymander them still, I think we're still going to have a lot of districts that are not competitive.
So what about the citizens' watchdog groups? I mean, what are they? They're happy with this? Is that the final analysis, Joe Engels?
They liked their proposal better. Okay. Yeah. In a perfect world, their proposal was better. But they also realized that, number one, that the legislators are elected to do this job. And they think that they've done it poorly in the past. But they do think that was, is part of their job. But the bigger thing is they were afraid that if they went out in November with their plan and put it on the ballot, and they were about 2/3 of the way there on the petition signatures and could have easily gotten the other petition signatures to put it on the ballot. So it probably would have been there absent this proposal in May. And it still might be out there. If this proposal in May, by the way, fails. They're still, working on getting that out there. So that we're going to see that if this proposal in May fails. But what they were concerned about were basically the Republicans who were pushing for some sort of plan in May. They were afraid they would come up with a lot of money and be able to go out and confuse people. This is not the easiest thing for people to understand, redistricting.
Even though I devote a portion of every
right. Well, and quite frankly, I bet your listeners understand it
better
very
than
well.
Yeah.
They understand it much better than the average bear.
Important.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can get enough money out there on the other side of this, we've seen, like you said earlier, we've seen all these proposals go down in flames because people don't understand the issues. And when they don't understand the issues, they vote no.
Hmm. All right. So,
but they support it. I think that
that's what I read.
I mean, when they were, and they had a seat at the table for these discussions, which I think is important to note. It wasn't just, the legislators meeting behind closed doors. They did, extend a legitimate olive branch to the ballot issue group and got their input on lots of things, all the way down to, specific words in the in the final proposal. And they said they were guided by, kind of like three main points that, you know, anything they come up, if they were going to support something, it had to, you know, have meaningful opportunities for bipartisanship for the minority party to also have a say. It had to, you know, curb gerrymandering, put some guardrails in for that, and keep communities together. And in their opinion, this proposal does do that. And I think, you know, certainly it allows the legislators are still drawing the maps, but they're also the ones that, you know, would be drafting this proposal. So they're not going to write themselves out of this responsibility. That was kind of, you know, a non-starter. But at that first stage where they need the 50% minority vote, it's really going to be on the minority party to kind of do the right thing and not be swayed by offers from the majority party to just, you know, put their votes in to get a map that maybe is the best they can
them
do.
Right. As individuals.
Right.
Versus...
They're the ones that are going to have to really be pushing for a fair, you know, a fair map, fair districts. Hmm. And also in this process, you know, there were some transparency features added. So they're going to have at least two public meetings to discuss these maps. The data is going to be made available publicly so that you can draw a map and I can draw a map. Anybody can, you know, your listeners can draw maps. And if they do get to that point at the end where they're, you know, the majority is going it alone and you know, they're going to be, it's going to be very hard for them to draw a map that really solely, you know, benefits their party because of the extra constraints. And they're also going to have to defend each of those splits, each of those, you know, maybe if there's an oddly shaped district, they're going to have to defend that. And that makes it harder, too, when you have something on the record saying why you...
Right.
Did something the way you did.
We are going to continue our conversation. You're listening to All Sides with Sam Fisher. It's our weekly reporters roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporters roundtable. We're going to get a look at the lineups on the May ballot. The filing deadline was last week, and it's all a done deal now. Another Republican entered the race at the last minute for U.S. Senate. Gets that complicated on the Republican side. Simple as heck on the Democratic side. It's still Sherrod Brown, the incumbent. Still with us, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Engels. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Columbus Dispatch Public Affairs Editor Daryl Rowland. Daryl, thanks again.
Great to be here.
And State House Reporter for Cleveland.com, Jackie Borchardt. Thank you, Jackie.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's see, another Republican. It's Cincinnati investment advisor Dan Kiely. He says he joins the ranks of U.S. Representative Jim Renacci of Wadsworth, Cleveland investment banker Mike Gibbons, Melissa Atkinson of Marysville, and Don Elijah Eckert of Galloway. Yeah, what do we know about? I mean, we know about Representative Renacci.
Right.
Okay. And Mike Gibbons.
Mike Gibbons was a co-finance chair for President Trump. A lot of people outside Republican circles haven't heard from him. He's from the Cleveland area, an investment guy. He was the main challenger. Obviously, this was kind of Josh Mandel's race to lose until a few weeks ago when he quit due to his wife's undisclosed illness. So that became a mad scramble. And for a while there, Mr. Gibbons was really trying to corner the market and prevent anyone else from joining in. Unfortunately, for his sake, Congressman Renacci did join in. I was at the Ohio Republican Party meeting on Friday when they made their endorsements. Mr. Gibbons and also Melissa Atkinson, who's a businesswoman from up in Marysville, been called to the White House as an example of someone that Obamacare harmed several months ago. The Ohio Republican Party decided to endorse Congressman Renacci for that Senate slot, and it wasn't even close. I mean, it was Mr. Renacci, you know, it was just two and three votes respectively for for Melissa Atkinson and for Mike Givens. Don Elijah Eckhart, who's run several races before, did not even show up for that meeting. Our new entrant from Cincinnati showed up, gave a nice speech, said he's been involved in politics for 3 days now. I don't think that went over well with people like Joanne Davison, who's been in it for many decades or whatever. Mm-hmm. He did not even get a vote in the endorsement. So if anything, it's probably a two-person race now, and we'll see.
Any sense about what motivates Dan Kiely to get in it at this point?
He talks about, you know, and I think there are folks out there sincerely say, you know, I think I can do better. I mean, good grief, we just talked about gerrymandering for all these minutes, and that's why do we even have this whole redistricting reform thing? It's because we have crappy office holders, and part of the reason we have crappy office holders, we've come to the conclusion, is we have a crappy process for electing them. So some of these guys are saying the same thing. You know, I can get in there and do at least as well as that, and they have money to do it. You know, he's talking about, at least for now, self-financing. Mr. Givens is a very, very wealthy man. He has already pledged millions of dollars to his own campaign. Even Jim Renacci, you know, one of the wealthiest members of Congress, when he was still in the governor's race, said, you know, told me personally, he could commit $15-20 million of his own money to the race. So in some ways, it's a wealthy person's game. They got the money. They've got the urge. The filing fee is not that steep. You only need a few signatures. Go for it.
What about the Republican endorsement process? Mary, I don't know if it became much of an issue at the Senate, but Mary Taylor apparently begged them not to endorse in the governor's race.
Yes, and so in the Senate race, so did Mr. Givens, okay, and so did Mrs. Atkinson. They rejected that. In fact, that was the first vote, whether to endorse in that race or not. Again, that vote was not close, and then the second vote was, who are we going to endorse? Mary Taylor made an impassioned plea both beforehand and then especially before the committee, and it was harshly critical of the process. She basically felt the fix was in. It was the good old boys club getting behind John Husted and Mike DeWine leading the ticket. And, you know, it was a done deal before any vote was taken. So she nuked him. She was more harshly critical of Mike DeWine than I've heard any Democrat be in the last 20 or 30
really?
Years.
Well, she referenced lasting damage to our party.
Yes. And like I say, it was very apocalyptic language. Like I say, she went nuclear on them. And frankly, it didn't sell well. You know, and it ends up she only gets two votes.
Felt like a threat. It sounded like threats or what? I mean,
well, and she said that she will not support Mr. DeWine if he is the nominee.
That came out before the vote.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think that was viewed, and you got to think who the Central Committee is. You talk about the establishment within the Republican Party. This is the who's who of the establishment, okay? Words like that don't go over well. You know, party loyalty means a lot. So she goes up in there and says, I'm not going to vote for the nominee no matter who he is. I think you guys are all wrong. I think you fixed the process. So it wasn't a big surprise. She was probably going to lose anyhow, but that sort of, she like sealed her own fate. But she said at the end, I don't know if I even want your endorsement because it's such a crappy process. And
you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR. It's a weekly reporters roundtable. The Republican Party issued its endorsements over the weekend. Mary Taylor didn't get it for governor. Mike DeWine did. Let me ask you, what do you guys think this means for John Kasich, who has supported Mary Taylor? I mean, he's a party guy, right? Not that
right much? Now, the party's kind of cooled on him because of the way he's reacted with Trump. I mean, I've talked to some party loyalists who are really kind of disappointed with his take on things.
I don't think it changed his endorsement of Mary Taylor at all. I mean, he's been pretty straightforward in saying that he will back her as long as she's in the race.
And I mean, if she loses the primary, the looking glass, though, for me, because he's been made a career out of opposing Trump and pretty much practically everything he stands for. And Mary Taylor supports Trump and pretty much everything he stands for. And John Kasich supporting her, I mean, I don't know. I don't.
She would just, let's be frank, she would just as soon not have his endorsement.
I know she would, so I'm trying to figure out what's his deal.
I don't know. Maybe he really doesn't like her. I don't know.
He wants to see her.
I think this is, I don't know. Far be for me to analyze John Casey, but
well,
it just seems like
on my show, so I can't ask him personally.
Well, I think it's a little loyalty from John Kasich. I mean, she was his running mate two times, and perhaps, I don't know, perhaps even pledged long ago, you know, I'll back you.
No matter what. Right.
Well, it appears that because we kind of are at the no matter what stage because she's going out and denouncing all the things he's going on national talk shows supporting. But yeah, yet he is the, you know, with friends like these, Mary Taylor might say.
It's not like he's going out of his way to, you know, make this known. He's not like campaigning with her or.
No, I know.
You know, it's kind of. I think he even said recently, you know, if endorsements mattered, I'd be president, you know, something along those lines. So,
well, that's if newspaper endorsements mattered.
Yeah.
Right.
What else? I mean, any other, there aren't any other contested races out there that.
The one other one that was mildly interesting from Friday from the Republican Central Committee meeting was for state treasurer. Sandy O'Brien, who is a former county auditor up in Ashtabula County, way up in northeast Ohio.
Yeah.
She, as I said, she was formerly county auditor. She was the nominee, I think, in 06. She actually upset Jeanette Bradley in the primary for state treasurer and then lost. She is running against State Representative Bob Sprague for the state treasurer's nomination. She gave a very impassioned speech as well. Again, sort of like Mary Taylor, critical of the process, but hers was totally, fellow Republicans, we have a women problem. And she had the statistics of how few women there were at the state and federal level, you know, from Ohio in that were Republicans. And she says part of it is this endorsement process, the very thing they were going through there. And women are stigmatized because they can't raise money, they can't get endorsements, what have you. You guys better get your act together. You see, the world is changing. And all that. And it was an interesting picture, quite frankly. You know, Sandra O'Brien is a veteran politician. She is not, you know, a young activist who's out doing the women's marches or anything, to my knowledge. But she was pointing out that problem. But again, she was just crushed in the process. Representative Sprague got the endorsement, and her concerns were kind of cast aside. And we talked to Jane Timken, who's the chair of the Republican Party, about her claims about women. And, of course, obviously, Republicans have a female chairman of their party.
Well, they do, but the numbers are undeniable. But the Democrats don't do that much better.
Right, being equal.
I mean, no one's
Jane
a pox on both their houses on that score.
Her response was, well, I can raise money, so obviously a woman can raise money. And of course, the Timken family, her husband Tim was been finance director in the past for the Republicans. And
they're extremely wealthy people.
Extremely wealthy, and they know how to get money for the party. So, okay, that was the response.
But I'm wondering about the likes of Joanne Davidson, former Speaker of the House, first woman Speaker of the House, longtime member of the House, longtime, you know, activist in the Republican Party. She's been saying we need more women, too.
Right.
But do they make their votes public, or are they—
No, it was by secret ballot. Yeah. They all marched up and filled out a piece of paper, and then they were counted.
The Democrats also have a contested race, do they not, for Treasurer Rob Richardson, Neil Patel?
Yes.
And are the Democrats endorsing?
Not yet.
Not yet, okay.
They're not.
Yeah, well, the last I talked to Dave Pepper, he said it was in the works. I don't know if that meant they were going to or if a decision on whether to do so was in the works. Yeah, you know, because their world became much more complicated because they got a glut of candidates, most of them unknowns. And again, when we talk about number of candidates we should note that these are not official candidates until their signatures are verified and all that. So there could be a few that drop off. We may not have these huge numbers. Mm-hmm. But
so we've got four Republicans and four Democrats.
Which race are you talking about?
For governor.
Mm-hmm. No, it's two Republicans and eight Democrats and one Green Party.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Oh, that's right. Of course. Yeah. some dropped out.
You know, that's really interesting. You look at that Democratic side of the gubernatorial race, and you've got some people who have some name recognition. Obviously, Dennis Kucinich has name recognition. Rich Cordray has some name recognition. But then you have others who have no name recognition. And you have basically... There's so many people in there, and the way that this could play is so interesting because, you know, you have the progressive wing of the party kind of going after the Dennis Kucinich, you know, that's kind of their person. And then you've got the more moderate wing of the party that's going out after Cordray and the others, some of the others. And, you know, you wonder how much the vote's going to get diluted. You know, when you've got that many candidates, mm-hmm. that anything can happen. I mean, it's really interesting, I think, when you have that many candidates. So it'll be real. The key will be, will they start dropping off and how that will advantage those that are left, in my mind.
Hmm. And each candidate, as Joe was mentioning, we can go on down the line. There are various constituencies for mm-hmm. each. As you mentioned, Dennis Kucinich with many in the progressive wing. He's proposed banning oil and gas drilling in Ohio. Bill O'Neill, the former Supreme Court justice, is big pro-marijuana, wants to legalize recreational marijuana, tax it, and use that to reopen mental hospitals to treat opioid addicts. Rich Cordray, the former Consumer Financial Protection Bureau director, former attorney general and state treasurer as well, I guess he's kind of the establishment pick in the race. Connie Pillich, the only woman on the Democratic side who's still actually running. Joe Schiavone, energetic state senator from Youngstown. And then there's a former male stripper we haven't even talked about yet. We'll see if Luscious Larry actually qualifies for the ballot.
Hey, he got 14% of the vote back in 2014 or something like that.
Well, I mean, how would he spend $1,000 or less?
Oh, I mean, that was with Ed Fitzgerald was the...
Yeah, right.
Was, yeah.
Right.
So...
Okay, we're not even going there.
Yeah. Yep. End of that conversation. Well, the primary is coming up in May. You guys have lots of work to do. Good luck. We'll be talking about it.
Well, the big one, Ann, that we haven't even talked about is Pat Tiberi's seat.
Right.
19 candidates
right.
have filed for that. Now, this is, according to some of my colleagues' calculations, this is... The reason there's so many people lining up, it's an open congressional seat,
right,
meaning
right.
there's not an incumbent
right,
running.
Right.
Now, that did happen just in 2000 when John Kasich left to run for president. Tiberi came in. And that happened a long time ago.
18 years ago.
Yeah. Well, then it happened again way back when Sam Devine, if you remember that name from area history, came in. And then before that, it was like, I think, 1920. So this is like the third time in a century we've actually had an open seat in the 12th Congressional District. Now, the 12th Congressional District, you know, it changes every 10 years.
Bit.
But but the number 12, it's always been a Central Ohio district. So it's amazing. So that's why you see 18 major party candidates and one Green Party candidate. And, Andy, you want to come back and help us write the previews for this primary?
The thumbnails?
We may have to put out a public plea.
It'll literally
be a thumbnail this time.
We may need to crowdsource this coverage. So if any of your listeners are adept at writing and non-biased and everything.
You know, that's something, though, to think about because we're sitting here joking about that. But when you have that many people in the race, mm-hmm. it is really hard to get free media coverage for these candidates to get free media. And when I say free media coverage, I mean free, meaningful media coverage.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it takes how long to just go through their names? I mean, you have, you know, 50 seconds in just going through their names. So, you know, if you're talking public radio to get a piece that actually explains, you know, how they are different on things, that could be a 4-minute piece and you're not likely to get too many of those. So, you know, that's just in the public radio world. So what about commercial radio where there's not 4-minute pieces? Are you going to even hear that? And, you know, when you're talking newspaper space, you know, you just can't drill down and get to the level that you would get if there were four candidates, you know?
Mm-hmm. We will continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. You just heard from her. Daryl Rowland, public affairs editor at the Columbus Dispatch. And Jackie Borchardt, State House reporter for Cleveland.com. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. We've kind of been mucking through the weeds here today and the post-filing deadline scenarios out there. If you have a question or comment about any of this, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And let's turn to Carl in Clintonville real quick. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Good day. I just wanted to make the comment that you're talking about having trouble getting media coverage for certain candidates. And I'm thinking, well, didn't the private Bone Spurs didn't seem to have any trouble getting coverage for his campaign?
I'm sorry, who?
Private Bone Spurs.
I think he's referring to President Trump's
who
bone spurs.
Got his okay. Well, that's he's in a category all of his own, Carl. But thanks a lot.
Yeah, he can get plenty of media coverage because number one, most people knew who he was to begin with, and he was a celebrity. And you know, our country is majorly focused on celebrities. But not only that, he had he had tons of money. But the thing that I always found the most interesting about President Trump when he was running for office is he knew the news business well enough to know how to game it, and he would anytime there was something major that would happen, he would call CNN and offer himself up to do an interview with them right away. He'd be on the line. And I mean, he made himself available. And that's huge. Someone who has that kind of savvy. But, you know, these candidates, by and large, that are running on the state level or for that district, they don't have that kind of media savvy. They don't have the big name. They don't have that kind of money. So it's a different game altogether.
Right. Carl, thanks a lot for that call. You know, someone mentioned something about marijuana back there when they were mentioning Bill O'Neill wants to legalize recreational marijuana taxes. He says it'll bring in $500 million, I think, a year in tax revenue. Be that as it may, it looks like Jackie Borchardt, from what you wrote last week, that the headline is Ohio Medical Marijuana Program Headed in Wrong Direction, former advisory committee member says. What are they saying and where is the program headed? What's going on?
Well, you know, Ohio's medical marijuana law passed in 2016, May of 2016. Can't say last year anymore.
2 years ago.
Yeah, 2 years ago. Set up a 2-year timeline for setting up the program. The bill, you know, kind of established a framework, but said, hey, all these nitty gritty details like how many, you know, companies can grow it, who can sell it, where they can, you know, sell it, all those things. Well, we're going to leave that to three state agencies to figure out over the next couple of years. So, you know, they did that process of working out those details and, you know, just in the last couple months went through the process of collecting applications for the various business licenses, for the growing licenses, the product manufacturers, and the dispensaries, the testing labs. And they awarded the cultivating licenses back in November, and the others are expected to be awarded this spring. So we're kind of in a period where there's nothing, again, really like tangible that you can see that's happening. Some of these growers have started breaking ground already. And that's pretty much about it. So, you know, for people who are waiting for this to start, it feels like an extremely long amount of time for people involved in the government bureaucracy of this whole program. They seem to, you know, say that, well, it's going as planned. And what happened it's a week and a half ago now, is that the patient representative on this advisory committee, which brought together doctors, pharmacists, there's a sheriff on there. It's kind of a hodgepodge of different interests around this topic. And they were supposed to give advice and recommendations to the state agencies that were writing these rules. And the way that the committee actually worked out is that they would have these rules presented to them and they might weigh in on them, but they really had no say in the process. And the agencies didn't have to take their recommendations and make those changes. So basically that this patient representative, he's a Columbus attorney, Ted Bebart, he resigned and basically said that he doesn't feel that the agencies use this panel, you know, to the fullest of their abilities to kind of guide some of these things, and that some of the rules that have been put in place are going to mean that Ohio's program is really restrictive, especially when it first opens.
What I mean, the panel doesn't actually have that much power.
They
it was
don't.
Kind of
and
a,
this is yeah.
It was
so so the
window
panel,
dressing wasn't
right,
it?
Right. And you know that was kind of the confusion on the outset as people were being appointed to this panel. I heard from a lot of advocates who were concerned because there wasn't a lot of marijuana knowledge on the panel, mm-hmm. And Ted Bebart being one of the ones who probably did have more knowledge on the subject. But you know they. This panel didn't actually have the authority to do anything. Back when the bill was going through the House and the Senate, the House wanted to create a new agency, so to speak, to govern this whole program. And they wanted to have this commission, and they would have, you know, again, these experts to kind of help them. But then when it went over to the Senate, decided that it wanted the pharmacy board to have a really big role in it. And the compromise was we're going to have the pharmacy board, the medical board, and the Department of Commerce kind of working on pieces of it. And one of the things that Mr. Bebart said in his resignation letter is that, you know, you've got these three agencies and you really need something that can kind of bring them all together or oversee them. And there really isn't anything like that right now.
And it seems like lawmakers aren't that interested in doing anything about it.
I think that, you know, lawmakers tend to want to see how something starts playing out before they tweak it and change it. And being that Ohio's program hasn't really started yet, I can see that, you know, if they and you know, I've talked with Kirk Schering about this. He's a Kent Republican. He was one of the leading Republicans on this. And he has said all along, you know, if things don't work, you know, I'm willing to start moving right away to try to, you know, get things to work. And that's one of the reasons why they had these three agencies come up with these details, because it's much easier for them to change some of this stuff than it is for the legislature to have a bill and have it go through. And, you know, anytime you have a bill, there might be fun little add-ons that get thrown in. You know what I mean? It can just get warped mm-hmm. by the time you pass
done.
It, or it might not
right.
even get done.
Yeah.
Or this way, at least if there's like a problem, you know, the Department of Commerce has the ability to like change the rule and start that process. And that wraps up much quicker than getting politicians involved.
We've already seen that they're not willing to change a whole lot, because when there were questions raised about the large cultivators, they were slow to respond on those. And there wasn't much change that came out of that. In fact, I don't think there was any change.
They're supposed to start dispensing in the fall.
Right.
In September. Right. Is it possible that will not take place?
It is possible.
It will be late.
It is possible.
Even though some people say everything's moving along swimmingly and it's going
right.
at the time frame.
And I mean, that was a big concern. Everyone thought when they were asking for these growing license applications in June that it might take the state like 3 months to look at them, because that's what happened in our neighbor Pennsylvania, who passed their law a month before us and they already have dispensaries opening.
Right.
So everyone kind of thought that it would take 3 months. And then 3 months later, they said, actually, we're going to announce them in November sometime. And that kind of put at least the growers I was talking to that caused some concern, because, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of them had they didn't actually own the property that they wanted to build on. They had an option, you know, to buy it or to rent it later if they got a license. They had to, you know, do all sorts of legal stuff to make sure they were good until they were the licenses. And then, So you get a license November 30th, and you're supposed to break ground in Ohio in the winter. I mean, if you're converting a facility, that's one thing. But if you're building a, you know, brand new greenhouse or warehouse, and we've had a pretty, you know, cold, wet winter here.
Is there something in the law that says the marijuana has to be grown in Ohio?
Yeah, cultivators are the only ones.
Cultivators are the only
licensed
ones.
Licensed Ohio cultivators are the only ones who can grow product to be sold here.
And just let's go back to Bill O'Neill for a second. The foundation of his platform is legalize recreational marijuana, legalize it across the board, and, you know, rake in the revenue. Is Ohio ready for that? I mean, most states are going that. I mean, states that there's an incremental process here. Most of the states that legalize medicinal end up going rec. So,
well, this is, if you look at public opinion polling, it has been kind of a slow march toward acceptance. I have not personally seen anything Ohio specific.
Yeah, I haven't either
recently. But, you know, Ohio, we're the bellwether state politically, so we're probably, you know, we're not going to be the pioneer on anything, but we're not going to be at the end of the line on anything either. So we're right in that mushy middle. So once we get 24, 25 states to do it, we may be in line then.
I think one thing to remember here is part of the reason that the lawmakers did this, put this bill out there and did their own program, is they didn't want outside interests coming in and setting up a marijuana program. You know, in 2015, Ohio voters rejected Responsible Ohio, and that would have allowed a lot more. And it would have been quicker.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they also saw this pushback. The legislators saw this pushback from people who said, you know, we see a medicinal value in this. We think that, you know, there are refugees, medical refugees in other states because they can't be here and get the medicine that they say helps their child or themselves. So you need to do something here. You know, you need to do something. So I think that they were kind of part of this came about because they wanted to do something, but they really, for some of them, that was the key issue in passing it. It wasn't that they wanted to do something quickly. It wasn't that there was any sense of urgency or that they felt compelled to do it right away. It was more like, well, we want to be doing something to keep a ballot issue from coming in.
Sort of like redistricting. And now some of the same Responsible Ohio folks say they want to come back to the ballot because I think maybe the time is more ripe.
Well, and also because they applied for a growing license and didn't get one and believed that the process was unfair and flawed. So, I mean, ironically, this law that was supposed to prevent a ballot issue might actually spur a ballot issue. And, you know, that they haven't released an amendment yet, proposed amendment. I've heard that it's still in the works and still, you know, going through
drafting. They
don't
have to do that until what would be their deadline?
Oh, I mean, their deadline is July 4th to turn in signatures.
Right.
For the November ballot.
They would have to pay people to collect
to get
at this point.
Yeah.
I think Responsible Ohio back 3 years ago, I think by the time they finally, I think that it was their second proposal to the Attorney General that was finally approved. Because, you know, there's various hurdles you have to go through. The first one is just getting your language.
Yeah.
Your petition.
Approved by the,
Your petition. Saying your petition matches what you're proposing. And usually it takes groups at least two stabs at that. And I think their second one was in March or mid-March. So they didn't even start collecting signatures till the end of March, maybe April. That's very short. And then they were actually short on their signatures. They had to go back and get more. So it's a very tight timeline, but not impossible if you have a lot of money.
We know it's not clear at this point where Ohio stands on the issue of marijuana legalization, but we do know that a majority of Ohioans support medicinal marijuana.
Oh, that's like 90. I mean,
yeah, that's a no-brainer.
That's a no-brainer.
And it just makes you wonder what kind of ire the lawmakers bring on themselves if they don't react to this in a timely manner.
Well, and here's the other thing we haven't talked about.
Or the administration, for, you know.
Right. We've been talking about the lawmakers and the program and all that. What we haven't talked about is what the potential court battle might be, because there are some groups out there who have been threatening to sue. I think there is one lawsuit
that's
been
filed. so far.
But any of these lawsuits or potential lawsuits that could come out, they could actually derail this program quickly. You know, you get an injunction against the state and they can't start on time. And there you go. There's your in for a ballot issue.
That's all the time we have today. We'll pick it up again another time. Joe Engels, reporter for Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
And Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch, thanks to you.
Thanks. Have the team together again.
Have the team again together. Jackie Borchardt for Cleveland.com, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.